Well, he told me that was quick, but that was quick. I'm Dave. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be here. Great to see everybody. Very welcoming group. I appreciate it. My sobriety date is July 14th, 2002. I was 42 when I got sober. I'm 64 now, so you don't have to try and do all that math in your head. I'm a member of the New Day group in Virginia Beach. We have 6 meetings a day, over 40 a week. So if you're ever in Virginia Beach, Billy can get you in touch with me and we'll go to a meeting together. I was born and raised down in Charlottesville. So I lived there till I was 30, did a fair amount of damage there. Was 8 when I had my first drink. I have 2 older brothers and an older sister actually who passed away 2 weeks ago. I was born on her 14th birthday. She got a kid to babysit for her birthday. And most of my early memories are with her. But when I was 8, I didn't like being the youngest child. I felt like they got to do more stuff and stay up later and all that, you know. So already I'm self-centered. I didn't know it, but I'm thinking about me and what I'm not getting, you know. And so anyway, there was a little family get together at our house, and me and a couple of cousins stole a Rolling Rock out of the cooler, a little 8-ounce pony. And that ought to tell you something, because I can't remember who my third grade teacher was, what her name was, but I know that was a Rolling Rock. I remember that. And I didn't get drunk. We went back in the clothes, you know, the clothes were hanging from the line and we got between them. And it's amazing. I remember all this. But we passed it around so I probably had a couple of swallows. But I immediately liked the way it made me feel, which was cool and older, you know, and hip and all that kind of stuff. And I didn't drink again until I was probably 12 or 13, but I started drinking pretty regularly at that time. I'd gone to church as a kid. My mother, we all went to church every Sunday at the Methodist Church, First United Methodist. I didn't particularly care for it because I liked being on the playground with my friends, you know, and it felt stuffy to me, and I didn't really understand what was going on. You know, there was a lot of talking out, but not much talking back, I was already breaking some of the rules, you know. So anyway, about 13 or 12 or 13, I took a class to join the church, and after that, my mother said, well, it's up to you now if you want to go, and I never went back. She was the disciplinarian in the house, too, and she had a lot of rules, which I didn't particularly take to. My brothers and sisters did very well with that and turned into fine, upstanding, non-alcoholic citizens. And I'm not saying that she did it. I was obviously predisposed the way that first one made me feel. But, I like getting away with stuff because I didn't like, getting yelled at or beat. So I learned to, not get caught. If I got caught once every 5 times, I felt like I was ahead of the game, you know. And so, even as a young kid, I was not the best child. So when I got to high school, she died when I was 17. So, I'm not going to church. She's the disciplinarian in the house. And, it kind of kicked my drinking into another gear. But also, I didn't have anybody to really answer to at that point. And I liked doing what I wanted to do, and I was able to do that a lot more. In high school, I liked being vice president of things. And I was vice president of the class a couple years and vice president of the SCA, I think, because you don't have to do anything when you're vice president. Yeah. The secretary, the treasurer, and the president do everything. You got this big title, you do nothing. Yeah. But we did have a key club, which is associated with the Kiwanis and supposed to be a service organization. And we did some service, but really it was a fraternity. And I wanted to be president of that, because the president controlled the kegs. And so at 16, we had our bank account in the Charlottesville High School account, I guess, because when I needed money, I would go to the office and they'd give me a check. And I went and bought 4 kegs at Esther the IGA supermarket when I was 16, They didn't even ask me for an ID. I had a fake one. Yeah, I got out of the Rolling Stone. But, times were a lot different then. And I was going to go to college. The rule of my house was you were going to college and you were paying your own way. Thank God it was a lot cheaper then. But I started delivering papers when I was eight, I think. We had a paper route that both brothers had had before me, and then I got it. My mother made us get little bank envelopes and do a budget and all that, which again worked well for them. I couldn't wait to be able to spend my money the way I wanted to. Again, didn't work out so well. But so I went, I got into three different schools. I only applied to three because I figured I did well in school. It wasn't because I put any effort forth. God just gave me a brain. It allowed me to do well up through high school without really working at it. So I figured I'd probably end up at UVA, but I applied to a couple other schools that, just to see if I got in. But the real truth of the matter is why I went to UVA, even though it was the least expensive of the other two out-of-state schools, is that I didn't want to leave Charlottesville. That's where my drinking buddies were, I was scared. I would never say I was scared at the time or had fear, and I didn't even recognize it. I didn't know how to inventory those kind of things like we do in AA. And so I went to UVA, and I also, one of my best friends from down the street got in, and so we were roommates, I didn't even have to go through that part. And so first year I did pretty well because I'd had a lot of the classes before. But I remember first year a guy across the hall said to me, "Don't you think you drink a little too much?" And I said, "What a nerd, Doesn't he know we're the cool kids?" I just left it off, of course. And so second year, my friend and I got a house. We lived off campus, and we had a combined 1.08 second semester. So I had a 0.82, so I felt like I was, doing pretty well. He had a 0.2. He ended up getting asked not to come back for a while, and he went on to run a he's president of a big general contracting firm down there that builds buildings at UVA. Not an alcoholic, was just a heavy drinker at that age. Never went back to school, did very well. He's still one of my best friends. Myself, I'd done well enough first year to where I got to stay in, but they sent my grades to my dad, and who was a big softy. I loved him. He wasn't an alcoholic. I never saw him drunk. He did have a liquor cabinet. He could have one and stop, or a half. I mean, he ran hotels, and they had back in the 70s, that was where the hot bars were and bands. And I used to cut grass in the summers there, and after work we'd go to the bar and I'd get a Pepsi and he'd get a cocktail, and I would look at the bottles and I'd love it, and the band setting up and the waitresses are running around. I like bars. And anyway, he got my grades, and we were at my grandfather's. He had moved out of town after my mom died. He couldn't stay. They grew up. Actually, he was born in Madison County, but they grew up together and went to what was then Charlottesville High School. They graduated in 42, I think, and got married. He went to World War II, but anyway, he pulled this envelope out and said, "Dave, what's going on? You got an F in math. You've always been so good at math." Of course, I've got a resentment that they sent my grades to him. Why'd they do that? I'm paying for it. But then he said he was disappointed in me. And you can beat me and yell at me, and that didn't really register. But when he told me I was disappointed, that hurt. And so I started going to class. It was a whole lot easier when I went to class. And I took a computer class, and I know now that was God also. I mean, God has sprinkled throughout my life. I just didn't recognize him. But I took a computer class, and I said, "Hey, I like this." I was in engineering school, but I didn't really want to be a mechanical or structural or any of that. And so I went into computers, and I did very well in that. Now, computer classes, you have a lot of projects, but you do them in the computer lab, and you can do them in the middle of the night with the other guys that bring a six-pack with them. Which is what I did, and stepped outside to have a smoke, but I did do very well in that. And I got a job at Sperry Marine. I don't know if any of y'all know that on 29. I think it's north of Grumman now. I got an intern job there. By the end of the summer, I was running a job, the software side of one. So they, when I graduated, they kept me on. I'd started dating a girl in college that was from Charlottesville, but went to UVA, and we dated for 7 years, I think. Lived together a lot of it, and drank a lot during that time. And I was, like the book says, I'm gonna paraphrase, I was totally incapable of being a true partner in a relationship. She would ask me, "What are you thinking?" or "What are you feeling?" And I would, white noise would go off in my head because I really didn't know. Again, I didn't know how to inventory that stuff or even really think about it. And of course, I'd respond with anger a lot of the time. And I just, alcohol changed me from the person I was when I was younger. The longer I drank, the surlier I got, the less fun I was to be around. The less I liked myself, the less self-respect and self-esteem I had, of course, from all the things I was doing. So anyway, at the end of the relationship, about probably it's probably 2 years later, I get this letter from her, and it's got this book in it. And the book's called Living Sober. And I'm like, Living Sober? Who wants to do that? And there's this letter that I really didn't pay much attention to that I know now was an amends letter. And a year later, she sent me another one, came to believe. Believe in what? I just had was just so self-centered and really closed-minded. I thought I was open-minded because I smoked a lot of pot and thought pot should be legal, but I was very closed-minded. If it didn't benefit me, I didn't want to, of course that would have benefited me if I'd done it. But I just threw them in the junk drawer with all the bills. She's been sober for probably close to 40 years now. So I did get a DUI in college. I think I was 19. I was driving too fast, which I'm prone to do even when I'm not drinking, but especially when I'm drinking. And a UVA cop pulled me over, and on the way to the station, he gave me a breathalyzer, a field test or whatever. And I was right on the line, and he took me to the station. But on the way to the station, we're talking about UVA basketball, and we got a good conversation going. And when we got there, he said, "If I hadn't called this in, I'd let you go because I don't think you're that drunk." Now, I still got arrested. I still got a DUI. But that, to me, I hear, oh, it wasn't that, I pat myself on the back. I kind of fooled him or whatever. But then after I was booked, he took me to the movie I was going to. I was meeting my friends at and dropped me off. Things are a lot different then, And I just did not pay any attention to it really. I did go to BASAP. They gave me a sheet. I was supposed to go to five or six AA meetings. I went to one. I remember thinking, the way I remembered it was they stuck us all the newcomers in a room by themselves, and we just sat there for an hour. I've gone to that meeting since. I know that's not true because I've gone there a lot down in Charlottesville. But I did get the part about not drinking that y'all were talking about not drinking. So I didn't go back. I had no interest in that. And I said, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm too young and too good looking and got it going on, So I just signed the sheet myself. I had four DUIs total. I never went to another AA meeting as a result of it. I just signed the sheets. I had what I'm saying with that is I had so many opportunities to do something about it, and I never did. And it was a lot of it was fear. Fear of giving up that way of life, of that crutch, of that medicine, whatever you want to call it, because at the last 10 years of my drinking, I was drinking to shut my mind down. So I wouldn't be thinking about all those dirty, nasty, rotten things I'd done and the people I'd hurt. The second DUI was 26, and it came with some contraband charges. And I got an expensive lawyer and managed to sneak out of that without a conviction. I got pre-conviction probation, I think it was called. And I did the probation and came out okay. And but again, I slid under it. I didn't pay any attention to it. But I did start a business at night with a guy that worked with me that I'd gone to college with. And the, you know, it was a software company. This was in the late, the mid 80s. So people were starting to do that and do pretty well. It was a utility for WordPerfect and WordStar. If anybody's old enough to remember those, we had the number one add-on. We were actually in the box for a while. And but he partied some, not like me, but he partied. And the I know now, looking back, the real reason I did that is because I didn't really like the guy that much, you know. But I hated going to work at 7:30 in the morning. I wanted to set my own hours, you know. That appealed to me to, you know, to be the partner in the business and go to work when I wanted to. All my decisions, you know, where I lived, who I hung out with, you know, where I went, were decided by alcohol, you know, where I worked. I would never have admitted it then or even looked at it, but looking back, it's easy to see, you know. We moved down to Virginia Beach. His wife was a doctor, didn't want to work at UVA. So they gave me the option of Northern Virginia, Richmond, or Virginia Beach. And I had one of my best friends I'd met at UVA lived at the beach. And it's the beach, you know? So I moved to the beach. That was about 91, I think. And so I thought that was the one time I thought, maybe I'll slow down now that we're moving, you know? I didn't think maybe I'll quit. Maybe I'll slow down. And all those guys won't be calling me to go out with them when their wives give them a pass. I'd have been going out anyway, but that's what I thought. Yeah. Within a week, I've got a new favorite bar, a new bunch of running mates, you know, because I took me with me. And, you know, it just kept getting worse. So, yeah, the next 10, 11 years, there are no real highlights in my life, you know, a lot of low lights, getting arrested, waking up every day saying I'm not going to do that again. By 3 o'clock, I'm starting to feel better and planning it, you know, and pushing my family away. They, you know, we had all kind of dispersed. They had gone to other states as soon as they could. And I was able to like transfer my denial to them. Like keeping them at a distance. And, you know, began to isolate. I'm sure y'all are familiar with that too. I was by the last 5 or 10 years, most of my drinking was done alone. I lived in a little hovel of an apartment out on the north end. And the business went under in about 98, I think, because Windows took our niche. And so I spent about 2 years on the couch. And I'm sure I'd have been probably diagnosed as clinically depressed. And I believe in those diagnoses and I believe in following what the doctor tells me to do in those cases. But for me, it was really just a big case of self-pity. Woe is me. I lost my business, lost my mother, lost my girlfriend, you know, all that stuff. And really, I just had no gumption left in me, you know, no get up and fight. I just drank, you know, when I could. And it was miserable. But again, I didn't know any other way, and I didn't wasn't willing to listen about it any other way. In 2000, well, I did have a quick stint as a hotel night auditor during that time. Anybody know what that is? You work in the middle of the night, you got a bar in there and food. It's a great job for an alcoholic. Yeah. But I got fired for barring the deposit one night. I took it back, but yeah, I did bar it. But anyway, it was like February of 2000, and the lights are off in my apartment. You know, I'm just sitting there in the dark. And my friend I spoke about earlier, who was my best friend I'd met at college, lived across the street. And he was partners in a clothing business, hip hop clothing. That's what we do. And he came over and he knocked on the door. He didn't come in because nobody really came in. It was, you know, it was very dark and dingy and dirty in there. But he said, "Look, if you go to a meeting with our mutual friend Palmer, I'll give you a job and pay your electric bill." And even I could do that math, you know, 1 hour and get my electric bill put on and get a job. Working for my buddy? Sure, I'll do that. And so Palmer is a guy who I used to run with. during my times in Virginia Beach. We ran hard together. I was there for his bottom, and he ended up in the other fellowship, but he was 7 years clean at that time. And so he took me to a meeting of that fellowship, and we left. They did a bunch of readings, and I said, "Oh, I should stop doing all that. But drinking's not my problem. I can drink. I'm gonna keep that in my back pocket. I'm an alcoholic. It started with alcohol, it ended with alcohol. It was consistent throughout my life. But he told me, okay, you can try that. He was smart. But then he called me the next day and said, I talked to a bunch of people with a lot more time, and they said, you probably can't do that. You know what I said? Watch me. A week later, I'm gone, off to the races, first paycheck, So for 2 years, I'm working for my buddy. He's not paying me much by my standards. More than I'm worth, I'm sure, at that time, because I probably showed up about half the time. But I started stealing from him. I started stealing those clothes because I could trade them for what I wanted. I could sell them to live the lifestyle I was accustomed. And you can imagine the shame and the guilt and the remorse that I have during that time. But I have to keep going. I have to keep drinking because that's the only relief I get from it. And that's fewer and farther between because you know that you don't get, that sense of ease and comfort doesn't last very long when you get to that point. And so on July the 13th of 2002, he and I and my buddy, my college roommate, the three of us go to a concert at the Virginia Beach Amphitheater, a little band from Charlottesville, y'all can probably guess. And my last drink was on the drummer's bus. I played football with the drummer. I didn't know it was my last drink. I had a beer. We all went home. They dropped me off at the seedy motel I was living at. Because, for a few years I had, before I would get a room at the beach. For they, you could buy about rent by the week during the winter down there. And then in April, I'd get an apartment and pay first and last month rent. And they'd kick me out in September or October. And I'd go back to the hotel at the oceanfront. But nobody would rent me an apartment anymore in the summer. So I ended up at the seedy hotel out in the middle of town. Anyway, I went to work that next morning. And my friend slash boss walked in and said, you've been stealing from us. I can't cover you anymore. I've got partners. They know what's going on. I got to fire you. Well, I'd been fired before, and I'd bounce back, I guess you could call it. But this time I was terrified. My stomach hit the floor because I had no idea what I was going to do. There was a padlock on the door at the hotel I knew because I was going to owe them money that night. I had nobody else I could con or manipulate or couch surf. There was nobody left. The way out the door, he turned with a twinkle in his eye and said, "Do you want to go to treatment now?" Because he had offered before, and I'd always said, "Hey, I'm not hurting anybody," which is one of the biggest lies I said. I mean, I'm stealing from them. I've got my family by then has figured out what's going on, and they're losing sleep, I'm sure, over me. And there was just a lot of damage that had been done. But this time I just, it was like an out-of-body experience, really. I could see myself saying, "Yes." And I wanted to grab it, stuff it back in. But he said, "All right, great." He didn't stay very long. He said, "Great, I'll try and get fix something up for you." So that night, I was still at work. Everybody had left. The lights are on. I don't know about y'all, but my mind was just spaghetti back then. And I start thinking those paranoid thoughts, the cops are going to drop by. They're going to see me in here. They're going to arrest me. And so I went out and slept in the woods behind the building. And I'm grateful for that because that's where I would have ended up anyway. And I go back there every year on my anniversary and check it out. In fact, my anniversary is in July, but I was just feeling a lot of gratitude about a month ago, and I went by there. I don't ever want to have to go through that again. Anyway, he came to work next day. And he said, "Where did you sleep last night?" And I said, "Under that tree over there." And he said, "All right, You come home with me tonight and I'm going to take you to Williamsburg tomorrow. So, but it's Wednesday now. The first one, he fired me on a Monday. I'm starting to feel pretty good. I haven't drank in a couple of days. You know, I'm thinking maybe I'm a little hasty here. And on the way up, I said, how long am I going to stay? And he said, well, they have a 5-day evaluation period. I said, oh, I can do 5 days, you know, three hots in a cot and come out and drink like a gentleman. And he dropped me off and we checked in, and then the doctor came in. And for whatever reason, I was truthful with her and I told her everything I was doing. And her hair didn't set on fire and she didn't go running out screaming. But she did say, I think I'm going to recommend that you stay for 3 months. I said, what? 3 months? Don't y'all have like a 28-day program? Yeah. And she said, yeah, we can start with that. And I said, all right. Yeah, 3 months. So that night, I went to my first little session in there when it was a book study. They were reading a big book. It was just one counselor and the inmates or patients. And they were reading a doctor's opinion. You know, they'd been through the whole book. I know a number of probably hundreds of times. I don't know. But that night, they were on the doctor's opinion. And we read that. And it said that once I start to drink, I don't stop. And when I'm not drinking, I'm planning it, talking myself into it, whether I went to jail or lost the girl or the job or the place to live, left on my own, I'm going to drink again. So that's my mind's default answer. Yeah. And I said, wow, I'm an alcoholic. Who knew? Yeah. Everybody knew but me. But there was some relief in that, in knowing that there was not a definition, but it was a disease and these were the symptoms and I had them because I just thought something was wrong with me, which it is, but I thought something really bad was wrong with me. Not that it's good, but anyway, there was a solution outlined in there too, which yeah, I didn't really understand, but they took me to an AA meeting afterwards and I got a white chip and so far that's the only one. About 10 days in, we were out in the Serenity Garden, you know, swapping war stories. And it was about 2 in the morning. And we were trying to learn something. It wasn't like sitting at a bar swapping war stories, although it wasn't that much different. But a nurse came out and said, you know, you guys need to go to bed. It's 2 in the morning. Well, I got angry. You know, I'm a grown man. Who is she to tell me what to do? I'm in the asylum. But, you know, still, I'm a grown man. Excuse me. But I went ahead and, you know, I wanted to get an AA treatment, so I went to bed. But I was angry. So I said the Serenity Prayer over and over because that was the only tool I had 10 days in. And it helped a little. And I woke up and took a shower, still angry, but I used the Serenity Prayer and it helped a little. And then I went to breakfast, and then I went back to the Serenity Garden, and this fellow that had 3 months, had been in there almost 3 months, came out. He was an old-timer around there, you know? And it took him an hour, but he convinced me that under that anger was fear, and that I was scared of giving up control. And once I believed that and understood it, I immediately went to, well, I haven't done a very good job being in control. I'm in the asylum, you know? Maybe I should, you know, do what these people are saying. Maybe I do need help, you know. Maybe I need to turn it over. Now, again, I don't have any relationship with a higher power. I didn't really know you could have a direct relationship with a higher power. I thought it went through the preacher, you know, or whatever, through the church. But I did go in and read the We Agnostics chapter and did a flow chart on the existence of God. Because I'm a software engineer. That's what I do. You know, I do a flow chart. And I started with there's no proof there's a God. And then I said, well, a lot of people believe in it. And if I let it go, where do it go? You know, and some other stuff like that. But I ended with, and it's still in my book, there's no proof there isn't. And that was enough for me to start, you know. And I had a couple of experiences in there where, like, they gave you a weekend pass to go home, and I had to take the bus. I didn't have a license or a car. And I was scared to death because I knew I could get off wherever I wanted and drink. And I said, got on that bus and I said the serenity prayer over and over for 45 minutes probably. And we crested the hill coming into the ocean front and the sun was coming up and I felt that warmth and I felt the peace coming over me that I hadn't experienced before. And even an old curmudgeon like me knew what was going on. And that happened to me again pretty soon after that, where I was very anxious about something and prayed and prayed and got a sense of peace and comfort. So, these things are starting to add up. I decided I needed a sponsor after I did the flow chart. So I stole a sponsor like I did everything else. There was a guy on the phone in the hallway. I said, "Who are you talking to?" He said, "My sponsor." And I just grabbed the phone from him and said, "Hey, will you be my sponsor?" I didn't know who the guy was, But again, God was in charge. That guy helped me so much. He started with, "Sure, call me every night at 10." I was like, "Every night? That seems kind of excessive." I didn't even have a phone. Phone was always bad news, but they had phones in the hallway. So I did. I called him every night. This was a case where fear worked for me because I was scared that he would fire me and I have to ask somebody else, So I called him every night. But the way things work, what happened was I didn't have to spill my guts every night. We talked about the day, what meetings we went to, what the topic was. And a couple of weeks later, boy met girl on AA campus, and I called him and he said, nip it in the bud. Like, remember, what was this, Barney Fife on Mayberry RFD or Andy Griffith? Anyway, I was not afraid to call him and tell him because I built the relationship in those couple of weeks of calling him every night, I was starting to be honest, It was weird, very weird. But I knew he had my best interest in heart, and I nipped it in the bud. We did a couple of steps while I was there. We met every week for dinner. I saw him at meetings when we went out, and he helped me tremendously. So I didn't have a place to live when I got out. My boss, I did re-up for the whole 3 months too when I got that sponsor. I said, I don't want to come back. I need to get all the help I can. So my boss slash friend, the founding partner, and my brother paid my tab. I didn't have insurance. I wasn't going to pay for insurance. I was drinking money. So they paid my way. So they agreed for me to stay. But then I was getting ready to get out and I didn't have a place to go. So my boss slash friend, he says, I'll get you a furnished apartment. I knew that wasn't a good idea, even me. I said, I can't go back to living by myself, at least not for a while, because I'll go back out. I know I will. And so they told me about Oxford houses. And I called, there were three in Virginia Beach. And I called every day for a week. And the night before the night, the day, 2 nights before I got out, one of them had a bed open. And I went the next day and did an interview and went to an AA meeting in Virginia Beach. And I got in. So the day after that, I left treatment. Went down there and moved into the Oxford house. My buddy, my boss, picked me up, driving me back. He said, everybody at the office misses you. They want to see you. Because he was giving me my job back. Things were happening that I had no control over and that I hadn't forced to happen, but I was doing the AA stuff. And a lot of this stuff is starting to take care of itself, which wasn't lost on me. I could, that's where my faith started to be born, that if I do the right thing and do what I think God wants me to do, which is stay sober and help others, that a lot of this other stuff either goes away or gets easier to deal with. We have principles to deal with them by. And so anyway, he said, they'd like to see you. And I said, no, I got to go to a meeting. They told me you got to go to a meeting the day you get out, or you won't. That's your best chance to stay sober. And so I went to a meeting. And then when I went to work the next day, they had a cake for me. Not a lot of anonymity involved when you leave for 3 months and come back and don't smell, you got clean clothes. So anyway, I was very blessed. I was living at the Oxford House. We were going to meetings together. We had chores and lived by spiritual principles. I could walk to a lot of meetings. I found walking was kind of like meditation for me, that, it clears my mind, and sometimes some thoughts wedge their way in there, some good thoughts. So I thought, I'll go by DMV just to see how much I owe and what I got to do and how long it'll be before I get my license back. So I went in there and I went to the lady up front at the thing, and she said, "Well, you were eligible to get your license back on October 4th." That was the day I got out of treatment. Yeah, how's that happen? I'd had four DUIs. I hadn't had a license in probably 10 years. I drove a lot during that time. If I had access to a car, I drove. And I got a lot of driving on the suspendeds, which added more time. But it took me five trips back to get my license, but I still was able to get it. It was right after 9/11, so they were pretty tight on. I had to have a bank statement, which meant I had to go to a bank, which meant I had a lot of overdraft fees that I had to pay. My first amends were to several banks to pay overdraft fees that I let slide, never pay. Anyway, I got my license. My sister gave me an old beater, a Mercury Topaz, and I was thinking on my walk, maybe I should use that to visit my old girlfriend in Ocean View. Anybody know about Ocean View? There's a lot of partying going on in Ocean View. And I'm thinking that's not a bad idea. But out of way right field, this idea comes. You should use that car to take somebody to a meeting. I was like, oh, I'm smart. I called my sponsor in Williamsburg, telling him how smart I was. Pat myself on the back. And he said, "Don't call me again until you get a sponsor in Virginia Beach. You almost drank. You need somebody to put eyes on you." And I said, "Okay." And so I asked the guy that shook the book at you at the meetings, because he was at all the meetings I went to, and he knew the book, and he helped me so much. I mean, he was different. He was special. He was gruff, but he took me through the steps, and he taught me a lot, and helped me with it. Also, I mean, within 3 days of that walk, there was a guy, new guy at the meeting, and he needed a ride. He had neuropathy. He only lived about a mile and a half from the meeting place. I picked him up every day for a year. He kept me sober, having that commitment. Again, things are happening that are just looking back. Where did that ha How'd that happen? Anyway, I went through the steps. I did. I hadn't done the third step. I'd done one and two. I thought I neatly evaded the God question, I think it says in the book. And my new sponsor kept saying, "When are you gonna do your fourth step? When are you gonna do your fourth step?" Yeah, I'm working. I'm thinking about it, working on it, whatever. About 6 months sober, I start thinking about all the dirty, nasty, rotten things I had done to people and all the harms I had caused. And the thought of a drink starts to enter my mind, because I know that'd give me temporary relief. And it stayed. And I went to a meeting in the morning. I called my sponsor. I went to a meeting at night, and it was still there. And I left the meeting in my car with a valid license and an inspection sticker and registered plates, which I hadn't done in a long time. But anyway, I came to a T intersection, and my favorite bar was a mile one way, and my Oxford House was a mile the other way. And I said, "God, please get me home tonight." And I got home. That was my third step prayer. "God, get me home tonight." It says in the book, the wording is optional. I abandoned myself to God in that moment. That doesn't mean I did it forever. I have to do that pretty consistently, a lot. But in that moment, I did it. And you could tell a non-AA, a non-recovering alcoholic, that story. And I said, "You just turned that way. I don't believe that. I don't, I wanted to drink, but I asked for help and I got it." And I know that because the next morning I woke up and I instinctively knew to go to the library and start writing. And I did my fourth step. And that was the last serious compulsion I had to drink. The thought has crossed my mind, sure. But it is easily dismissed because I know it's a lie. And I know I'm the kind of drinker that one drink, it's off to the races. You know, there's no coming back from that for me. So I did the fourth, I did the fifth in the kitchen at the church that we had the meetings at. We did six and seven real quick, you know, as the book, the 12 and 12 says, that's a lifetime job, still working on the character defects with God's help and guidance. Had a long eight-step list, a lot of family members, a lot of co-workers, a lot of landlords, you know. But I made a lot of amends, and you know, I'm sure there's a couple more I need to do. I didn't make a few for like probably 7 or 8 years because it took me that long to do the willingness part, which for me is forgive them for what I perceive they might have done to me. One of them was my former partner. So we went to dinner. I'll just tell this real quick. It's been at least 8 years since I quit drinking. And I made an amends to him, and he said, "Oh, it wasn't that bad. Don't worry about it." Yeah. I said, "No, you know, it was. I got to tell you this." Other people, on the other hand, said, "Yeah, you're still a jerk. You know, I don't want to see you anymore." Most of them, though, said, "I really appreciate you telling me this, but I can see that you're different. I can see your actions are different, you know, and that's what this is about, is our actions. You know, through the actions that I did with AA, other stuff started to happen. Faith started to grow. I started to be able to see where God was in my life instead of ignoring it, you know. And about that time, I started going to New Day, my home group, at 7:30 in the morning. That was a big deal. I used to hate the sunrise. I hated hearing the birds chirp because, you know, I'd been up all night, or I'd gone to bed at 5. But I started kind of like getting up in the morning, and I liked having a clean my bed made when I got in it at night. You know, all those things that seemed so uncool to me when I was, you know, out there drinking. But I started going every day at 7:30 in the morning. Then I'd go to work, then I'd go to a 6 o'clock meeting. And I met a guy. There was a guy at the 7:30 a.m. that had what I wanted. He was happy, joyous, and free. Everybody liked him. Everybody spoke to him. He taught me how to make coffee because I didn't know how to make coffee because I didn't drink coffee. Because coffee's bad for you, right? That's what they used to say anyway. I'd do anything else you put in front of me, but I didn't drink coffee. Yeah, I drew the line of coffee. It's really because I was still a kid, you know. Coffee was too adult. Yeah, I was just a little boy still inside. And but he taught me how to make coffee. Went over to his house one day, and I said, "I really like your house. You know, it's really nice." And he said, "It's not my house. It's God's house. He just lets me live here." I said, "Wow, will you be my sponsor?" I had to call the other guy and let him know, he's been my sponsor for 21 years now. I call him several times a week. He calls me. I take him to a meeting every Saturday morning. He doesn't drive anymore. But Van helped me, the number two sponsor, through nine, but he didn't have what I wanted spiritually. And this guy did. So I've been doing 10, 11, and 12 with him for 21 years. I love him. His name is Billy. Yeah. So the group at I don't know, I was 9 months maybe sober. We had started a 6 p.m. meeting. So we were in a strip mall right next to a bar. We're still there. Footer's Bar in Kempsville on Virginia Beach. The doors are literally this far apart. You got your choice every time you come, which door you walk in. But so we started that second meeting, and we had a business meeting, and they made me the treasurer. Yeah, I'm a thief. I've been sober a year. They made me the treasurer, and there's 12 meet no 14 meetings at a time at a week. You know, it's a fair amount of money coming through there. I'd never learned how to balance a checkbook, or let me just say, I'd never balanced a checkbook. It's not that hard, you know. But I figured if I had checks, I had money. Yeah, that's the way I live. Ergo, all those bounce check fees I had to pay. But it was your money, you know, that mattered to me. And I learned to balance the checkbook and to do the reports. And not too long after that, I was the chairperson of the group a year or two later. And the fellows who had their business there, they're both members, they decided to move out, and the group took over that space. And we did a shadow 501c3 so we could sign a lease and get insurance and pay electricity and all that. And we're up to 40-some meetings a week now. It's not a clubhouse. It's one group. We close the meeting. We close the space in between meetings. You know, we're not supposed to have anybody sleeping overnight. It's happened a couple of times. But, you know, I love that place. I've seen so many people get sober there. And it's really been good for me. Started sponsoring people. There's nothing better than that. That's the payoff. If you've been here a while and you've gone through the steps, please sponsor somebody. The guys I've sponsored, not all of them have done that. And eventually they just kind of go away. But to watch somebody get sober and see their eyes, their head lift up instead of looking at their shoes all the time like I did, and their eyes open up and they call you excited about something that's happened to them, or, you know, some spiritual experience they had. Man, that's good. I don't like that. And I had book studies in my house for a long time. Haven't done that since the pandemic started. Plus, I moved to a condo with limited parking. But we may have to start that up again. We've been talking about it. Sponsor line meetings where everybody and the sponsor tree gets together and we talk about the three legacies. You know, all that stuff, when you do it at your place, it brings spirituality into the home, I believe. It really makes it a calmer, peaceful place to be. And I've been able to continue my service journey. I went back to school when I was about 4 or 5 years sober. I wanted to see how I do sober, you know. I got that first degree, but I wanted to do something else. So I signed up. I was going to be taking night classes at ODU. At the school, I didn't want to do it online. I'm old school. I wanted to be in the classroom. And so I knew that I might start drifting away doing that. And I became the alternate intergroup rep. You know, I said, I'll take that job, you know. Barely keep me connected. And 3 months later, the intergroup rep moved, and I'm the intergroup rep. And I'm at the intergroup meeting, and we didn't have a website then. And this fellow in my home group had done a website with all the meetings on it, and the intergroup had decided to adopt it. And they wanted an intergroup website committee chair. And he literally took my hand, pushed it up from my elbow, put it up in the air. And I became the intergroup website committee chair, which, again, is God's work, because that kept me connected, you know, and I could have drifted away at that time. I still went to some meetings. I still probably went to 4 or 5 meetings a week, but having that service position really keeps you connected and sponsees. I did the same thing with GSR. I was alt GSR, and 3 months later, I'm GSR. Then I was alt chair. But I didn't think that was the whole term. No, 3 months into that, the DCM, I was all DCM, and the DCM moved, and I become DCM, you know. And all of that, you know, next to my first pass through the steps, service has afforded me the most growth in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's taught me how to play nice in the sandbox with other people, you know, how to continue to think about what's best for AA as opposed to what I think, you know, to listen to other people's opinions, to help stay open-minded. In fact, most of the time, I just try not to even have an opinion. You know? I try to be a clean slate because there are a lot of people that know a lot more than me. Amazing what Bill and Bob were able to do, and, you know, being the first ones, all the work they did, my God. But I've done a number of jobs at the area. I just started as the alternate delegate So that's definitely one I need to be a clean slate on, because I know, that's fa outward facing towards the General Service Conference as opposed to state facing, which I've been doing. Christy is the delegate, so I'll learn a lot from her and just follow her lead. I can't really think of a whole lot. Well, I have the such better relationships with my family. We talk about things other than weather and sports now. They call me for help sometimes. That's freaky. I had them on pedestals, and I still do. I love them to death, and they're great people, but they sometimes call me for help. I'm like, wow. And I started telling them I love them, which we didn't do in our family, and they do it back now. I have a girlfriend who's not in AA. We've been going out for 5 years. That's a I dated some women in AA, but she doesn't drink. She used to, but she's not alcoholic. That's working out pretty well. She has a condo in the same building, so that really works out well. Yeah, she doesn't have to be around me all the time. Work. I love going to work. Well, I wouldn't work if I didn't need the money, but still, the same place I used to hate, the job I hated, the people I hated, not anymore. One, they saved my life, and two is, I just enjoy it. I enjoy being around people again. I wasn't there when I got, I went to treatment, but y'all have gotten me there again, and I got a higher power with me all the time too. So I'll close up by saying that I've gotten so much more out of this than I put into it, and I've talked some about math tonight because I'm a math guy. And if I talk to other people that have been around a while, they would say the same thing. They've gotten more than they put into it. And if you add it all up, where does all that extra come from? It comes from your higher power and your higher power, y'all's higher power, and my higher power. Thank you.